This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. The United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, has warned that global human development, which can be measured as a combination of the world's education, health and living standards, could decline this year for the first time since the concept was introduced in 1990. Though the world has weathered many crises over the past 30 years, the impact of COVID-19, with its triple hit to health, education and income, could signal the largest reversal in human development on record. But concerted action with a focus on equity could still limit the impacts of this unprecedented crisis. So we're going to explore how with Niloy Banerjee, the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. Welcome, Niloy. How are you today?
Hello, Juliet. Thank you for having me. I'm well, and I'm hoping your listeners are well too.
Yes, I hope they are too. And I'm doing very well. Thank you. And, you know, it's been about 6 months, you know, since we last spoke, and what a different world we are living in since we last had that discussion. But I mean, just to remind everyone, you know, when we did speak in January, it was about the 2019 Human Development Report, of course. And, you know, we were talking about how the problem of inequality is not beyond solutions, right?
That's correct. Yes.
But let's get straight into this new report. UNDP has warned that, as I mentioned earlier, the coronavirus could reverse human development for the first time in 30 years. So this new report by the agency is titled COVID-19 and Human Development, Assessing the Crisis, Envisioning the Recovery. So, you know, it states in some aspects of human development, the pandemic has created levels of deprivation not seen for 40 years.
That is correct, Juliet. Although I must first introduce the caveat that these are global averages. So we are as good as our weakest link here. But still, since the Human Development Index is a composite index with income, health and education as the main pillars on which it stands, you can imagine that all three have suffered in the COVID crisis, all three pillars. Incomes have taken a big drop. Global per capita incomes are down already about 4%. Mm-hmm. So in general, every country will be impacted, as you can see in Malaysia also, because there has been an economic contraction and GDP is down about 1.7%. So there's a hit on income across the board. There's a hit on health, of course. I mean, notwithstanding the terrible tragedy of 360,000 plus people dead all over the world, but also health is sometimes a direct function of income, because there are large swathes of the population that rely on day-to-day earnings for their social spending, health, food, etc. So there's a direct impact on health. And finally, on education, this is the most insidious of all, because again, not so applicable to Malaysia, but certainly there are pockets in Malaysia that have the same problem. Mm-hmm. You see, as education moved online with the social distancing and stay-at-home rules and procedures, you can imagine this validates now our human development thesis that digital inequalities are among the largest emerging new complex inequalities. Mm. So as education moved online, there are millions of families that just don't have that infrastructure at home, cannot provide for it, and children do not have room, physically the space, because of crowding and multi-member occupancy. They don't have the room to actually do their continue their studies. So it's a really, really difficult situation. And it's expected that this is equivalent to a school dropout. And in large parts of the world, this is particularly sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, this is going to be a serious problem. How do we bring these kids back to school? Okay, I'll leave it at that. But yes, we could explore some of these themes
Yeah, but you know, I guess something the report said was also that the fallout from the pandemic is expected to hit poorer economies harder. Isn't that right?
That is absolutely true. I mean, it's now becoming, I mean, we are seeing every disaster, whether it's natural or man-made or a health-related or a climate or a nature, natural disaster like an earthquake or a flooding. The impact is always on the poorer and the vulnerable. And that goes for countries, but also individuals. When we unpack the Malaysian case, we will see a little bit how disproportionate the impact on poorer people is.
Okay. And still talking about education, you know, I was reading from the report that school closures mean fewer children are being educated than in the 1980s. Is that accurate?
Yes, that would be accurate because, as I said, it's millions of children just simply not being able to participate in the digital learning space. Do not have the infrastructure at home, do not have the space at home, and frankly, do not have the faculties to be able to use computers and cell phones to actually study and learn. It's a whole alien environment for them.
And now just going on to the health, the other thing that really stuck out for me was, you know, the focus on treating the virus, that could actually lead to an extra 6,000 preventable childhood deaths every day over the next 6 months. And that was really frightening.
Yes, that's correct, Juliet. It's simply a question of finite health budgets and where governments choose to put that budget. So many governments, for example, spend significant parts of their public health expenditure in single vertical programs like immunization, primarily for children. And the immunization just immediately after birth, the set of immunization treatments that you have to go through, et cetera, which is, you know, with the diversion of budgets to this emergency, there's clearly going to be some impact on what regular health budgets look like. So yes, it's a big risk.
So it seems like the poorer and, you know, children are being heavily impacted by this as well. I mean, all members across society are being impacted, but the crisis, I think, has also shown that if we fail to bring equity into the policy toolkit, you know, even more, many, many more will fall further behind.
Absolutely. This is equity is, if you see the SDGs, if you read the 2030 agenda document, the core value of leave no one behind is precisely that. The equity question is rapidly becoming a question of people being left behind, people falling behind. And as we said in our earlier conversation, Juliet, it's no longer the classical issues of wealth and income inequality. It's inequalities of opportunity, inequalities of access to a digital world, inequalities of access to more expensive commodities because the climate is having an impact. And now we see that primary healthcare is no longer the only floor to which we aspire. We need to now have, COVID has clearly shown us that we need to now have fairly sophisticated healthcare systems if we are to fight pandemics of this scale and scope, because COVID is not not something that, you know, you could walk to the village health clinic and get treated. So it needs hospitalization, it needs sophisticated equipment like ventilators and stuff. So it's now almost tertiary healthcare becomes almost the base condition for health. This is a huge shift in public policy and budgets. Absolutely. So equity now, it takes on, the stakes just went up on what does equity look like.
And what does equity look like? You know, how do we even respond to this current crisis, for example? You know, I know that the report has identified some principles. Maybe you can help me walk through them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that we are learning, certainly in the last decade or so, where the global income and wealth situation has become so polarized, you know, there are very, very stark numbers of how much wealth is concentrated in the hands of the top 1% of the world's wealthiest people.
That's right.
But that's not it. It's also now that the so-called upper middle class is splitting away quite rapidly from from the B40 and the lower ranges of the M40 income group. So what's happening then is we now fundamentally need to rethink the social contract. How do we take care of people who just do not have the capabilities or have not been endowed with the capabilities or sit in an ecosystem which can access the productive parts of the economy. So if so, then we really need to revisit our social contract. I think a model much more based on cash transfers, on universal access to some sort of insurance against unemployment, some sort of insurance for old age. So basically, there's a conversation going on in UNDP about whether, as a policy choice, we start to advocate what is called the universal basic income, wherein every person is entitled to a certain amount of minimum livable income, irrespective of their economic status or educational qualifications or their ability to work or not. And it's becoming a serious conversation. It does seem that the project to make all boats rise with the tide is going to take longer than we had anticipated. And setbacks like the COVID crisis and the fall back to the 80s level of human development don't help. But it certainly seems that for a while we need to be taking care of the poorer and the vulnerable parts of our population in a empathy-driven, equity-driven way. But this is not just love and fresh air. This is also a prudent public policy. We cannot be having 30-40% of our fellow human beings living in tremendous deprivation and get away with it. There will be consequences for that.
I'm speaking today to Niloy Banerjee. He is the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we're discussing COVID-19 and human development. You know, we're assessing the crisis and envisioning the recovery. You know, this is part of a study that has just been released by UNDP. And we're going to continue dissecting this study after this quick break. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me today is Niloy Banerjee. He is the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we're discussing a new report that was just released by UNDP, which, you know, had some very stark findings. It has warned that for the first time in 30 years, this coronavirus could reverse human development. So, you know, some very stark and some very scary sort of outlooks there. But what is the outlook for Malaysia, Niloy, as far as you can tell, you know, based on everything that's been happening?
Malaysia's pre-investments in health and education are clearly paying off. Malaysia's handled the crisis quite well. Again, as I said, the health dimension of the crisis requires sophisticated healthcare, and Malaysia obviously rose to the challenge. And I must say, Malaysia also did quite well on the collective action, the social action part. I know there were, roadblocks and police checks.
Yes.
Disciplining of the general population. Listen to us. But by and large, Malaysians have shown that their collective action is very much in place. Some other countries, it has been much more difficult to get, an obedient population that listens. Appeals by the government or by the authorities, so that worked and people took a hit even on their sentiments and beliefs, because for the holy month all sorts of congregations were stopped and people kind of complied. I mean, it was quite a good show of collective action and solidarity. Now, so health and education, we will skate through and bounce back, I think, quite quickly. The path of pain is the economy and household incomes. Mm. At the macroeconomic level, the numbers are there for all of us to see, not least because Malaysia is also a highly sort of outward-facing economy. A lot in Malaysia depends on how the rest of the world is faring. So the export markets, supply chains. Therefore, Malaysia is a little more vulnerable than Most countries with a large domestic market, such as Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, and even Thailand, whose domestic market is almost twice the size of Malaysia's. So all told, Malaysia's pain point is really on the economic side, because at the very macro level, there are concerns with the debt to GDP ratio. It's rising. Quite a few of my economist friends believe it's now above the 55% limit. There is also the drop in exports, the drop in foreign direct investment, the drop in new companies, new limited liability partnerships being registered. And Malaysia's GDP has contracted from, even in the last quarter of 2019, it was about 370 billion ringgit. It's now at 344 billion ringgit in the first quarter of 2020. So overall, that's also going into this crisis, there were already bad slowing signs in the commodities market, falling petroleum prices, the China-US trade war, and of course, some disruptions in the palm oil export markets. So overall, quite a unfortunate perfect storm for the economy. And then came the COVID thing and the need to inject a fresh stimulus into the economy. But then comes what happened at the level of the household, which is quite dramatic. I think the upper middle class and the T20 just skated into the digital world without batting an eyelid. But then anything, income groups below that really suffered, because say, the small and medium enterprises, micro small and medium enterprises, which employ about 70% of all private sector employment in the country, they severely contracted. Some indeed stopped production because running costs couldn't be met. Mm. And some downscaled and some just shut shop. That's so right. There's a lot of huge loss of income at the level of the retrenchments that happen of the, you know, the shop floor worker. So that's families who have lost sources of income. But the other dramatic impact, Julia, is we saw that traditionally non-poor, such as drivers of e-hailing cabs and motorcycle delivery people, the boys and girls who do deliveries on motorcycles, who are traditionally they're not below the poverty line for sure, but they are not even at the lower end of the M40 scale. They lost income. Mm-hmm. So daily wage workers lost incomes, and there will be a slide back, because they have now had to borrow, because none of this group have big cushions of rainy day money. Or access to insurance or access to any kind of risk buffer. So it's always day-to-day living. And so these categories slide back because they, you know, there's an unforeseen shock in the family, like a death or even a celebration like a wedding, they have to borrow because there's no buffer to fall back on. So this is a big, big, big new realization how easy backsliding is possible, how vulnerable we are at the bottom end of the income scale. And I take this one step further. A lot of women who were in part-time employment, not least those who provide nursing and home cleaning services, quite a few migrants there, lost their sources of income because they get paid on a job done basis rather than on the monthly retainer basis. So overall, again, the pain for Malaysia is through the wallet, both at the macro level, but also at the household and human level.
But the one thing that everyone is saying that from this pandemic is that we have to build back better, right? We have to assess everything that we've been doing wrong, which got us into, as you said, you know, even before the crisis hit, there were already signs of, impending recessions or, you know, impending downturns. So what should our priorities be for a socioeconomic economy recovery, post-pandemic?
Okay, let me answer that, Juliet, in two parts. One, the principles that we first must bear in mind in designing this Build Back Better, and then maybe some actual concrete steps. The principles are very, we talked a bit about the equity lens. We must design from the point of view of equity. We cannot simply design for growth and opportunity. We must, digital equity, we have to somehow make broadband and some digital skills available to everyone. And that may be purely public expenditure funded. The market will not support such things because there is no revenue model in that.
Mm.
Like I said, we have to take care of our poor and vulnerable in a different sort of way, with empathy. So design from the equity lens, clearly. Second, design from the capability lens, address the issue of the next generation capabilities are required. We thought early childhood survival, a good primary education, this is the basic floor that a country needs. We now realize that digital education, access to quality tertiary healthcare in times of unknown and pestilential disease like the one we are just going through right now. A second generation capabilities just became the new normal, not the first generation capability. Third, design for multidimensionality. And this is absolutely, absolutely critical. This is a multidimensional problem. It's like a boat which has suddenly developed multiple leaks. If we put our finger in one leak and forget the others, we are just not doing ourselves any favor. So this is not... Build Back Better is not a sector by sector fix. Let's get aviation going and then that will fix tourism and that will fix the hotels and that will fix the daily wage workers in the hotels. It's not a sector by sector fix. We have to fix the economy. We have to fix the health. We have to fix the household incomes and productive capacities. We have to fix the environment.
Mm.
And the environment part is really, really important here, because if we don't take this moment in time to rethink where we have taken the wrong turn in our development trajectory, if you like,
mm-hmm.
If we at least don't have a conversation and begin to nudge our rebuilding in a different direction, I think we would be missing a huge, huge, huge opportunity. And you talked about some countries lowering environmental standards, some countries leaving the Paris Climate Agreement. Some countries saying the WHO is not a credible organization. I mean, this withdrawal from the global community of norms is extremely dangerous at this time, because at the end of the day, norms saved the day, because every country almost followed a global SOP in this COVID crisis. The social distancing first, the contact tracing next, the testing third, and then the prevention and the cure. I mean, where do you think these norms came from? They're global norms set somewhere. And every country quickly adopted them. No, if everybody had to invent on their own each time how to deal with the COVID crisis, we would be in this crisis much longer. Anyway, that's, I think the multidimensionality is absolutely... So now the specifics for Malaysia, I think focus, a big, big focus on the small and medium, micro, small and medium enterprise sector, looking at how to learn from the shock of this round so that it doesn't ever happen again, which means some sort of risk insurance. If I can't open my food truck for 30 days, if I can't do business, some loss of business insurance, some protection there, some protection for loss of income, and because in many cases production was ramped down, so the shop floor workers lost a part of their income, if not their entire jobs.
Mm.
So that's a big one. Also, modernizing the micro, small, and medium enterprises, getting them more plugged into corporate supply chains. The other thing we found very, very painfully is they are not on the digital platforms. So these small enterprises are not plugged into e-commerce, because those who were plugged into e-commerce just seamlessly transitioned into selling online. So let's learn from this time so that we can provide better guarantees for these folks the next time. So that's one. Second, focus on the digitalization of the economy. Many of us transitioned quite seamlessly into this, but we didn't, not everybody transitioned well. So a hard look at what are the incentives for e-commerce? Can women who lost their jobs, could we have done a better job of keeping them plugged into the e-commerce market as suppliers, not as consumers, so that they could have had continued some modicum of their incomes could have been saved. Likewise, look at telecommuting now as a serious policy instrument. And this one, I think, would be particularly beneficial for Julia, the large numbers of Malaysian women, highly educated Malaysian women, who are out of the labor force and providing unpaid care work in the home with elderly or children.
Or both.
Or both, indeed. Use the stimulus package, both the Perihatin and the more recent one, the Penjana, to nudge the economy to a greener, have a conversation about whether the fossil fuel-based mix of Malaysia's energy production can be somewhat moved towards renewables. Renewables are only 8% of Malaysia's energy production. Mm-hmm. And many countries are doing that. As you know, Germany is giving the bailout to many corporations and businesses, but saying, putting down some serious conditionalities on what that means for their carbon footprint and what targets they have to meet in the next 10, 15 years. The government of France, as you know, is been in the media quite a bit, is bailing out Air France, which was in trouble.
Yeah.
But along with that bailout comes huge conditionalities about reducing its carbon footprint. And in fact, also discussing with Air France that they should eliminate short-haul flights within France because people can take trains.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a conversation starter. I mean, there'll be lots of hoops to go through, trade unions, management decisions, banks and lenders who will participate in the bailout. But it's a conversation that absolutely must begin. The third area I would submit for Malaysia is the area of looking at strengthening local governance. Our UNDP programs are quite capillary in nature. They're out there in the states, then in cities and local councils. And we found that, you know, the microeconomy or the micro society of every city or locality or district is different. It's variegated.
Mm.
And the impact on the microeconomy of each city and municipality is different. So while the health response is kind of templated and uniform, the economic response is not going to be. So Taiping, for instance, has a larger population of the elderly, which is quite different from Miri out in Sarawak, which has strong sort of nature-based economy ecosystem. So totally different economic responses in different localities. So strengthening local governance, most of all, what we find is that there is no localized data. So DOSM is a brilliant organization, and the macro aggregate data for Malaysia is available.
Mm-hmm.
It is also available for slightly subnational level, but at the level of a city, at the level of a town, what you're interested in is what is my plastic, daily plastic pollution load? What is my daily, how much am I putting in the landfill?
Mm-hmm.
That data is very, very, that granular localized data is very, very difficult to come by. So we need to, as part of this local, strengthening the local, we need to really think about local data systems, local ecosystems of data, local planning, strengthening local planning systems, and certainly providing more digital platforms for the local economy to function, local e-commerce, local information channels, business-to-business connections. We also found that small and medium enterprises sell very little to each other.
Interesting.
You know, the whole B2B model is just not there. It's a very much business to consumer model. Because, you know, these are things that we would need to focus on, and of course, and the big ticket issues of how to rethink some parts of the Malaysian economy at the most macro level. Whether government borrowing now really needs to take a hard look at itself, whether the export market needs to be more variegated. So, for example, Malaysia exports very large amount of aircraft parts to the Western world, particularly to the US. Mm-hmm. Now, the disruption in that supply chain is a big hit. And then at the other end, Malaysian exports are very, very sort of primary extractive commodities, petroleum, gas, palm oil, etc. It seems a middle band of exports may be needed so that, you know, you're not bound to only high-tech countries. It's quite interesting. Malaysia's exports to all the high-tech countries has fallen, whereas not so much to Indonesia. For example, the export to Indonesia have actually risen. But Taiwan, Japan, the U.S. exports have fallen. It just tells you what the export basket is composed of. So it's quite interesting how, there maybe needs to happen a very honest conversation about diversifying the export portfolio, considering Malaysia will in the foreseeable future remain an export dependent country. So, you know, it can't be just a China facing or a US and Japan facing export. Probably a more new export markets also need to be explored.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, there is a sort of a narrow window of opportunity to sort of kickstart all of these things, right? Are you hopeful that, you know, leaders, world leaders, you know, are going to do the right thing as such and, you know, not use, as we were talking about earlier, not use the pandemic as an excuse to go back on policies, weaken standards that are already in place?
I think it'll be both. You will see some extremely progressive thinking. You will see some terribly populist thinking. Mm. And I think at this time, more than ever, you can justify both ends of the spectrum with equally passionate arguments.
That's right.
You saw that the Pinjana package includes 100% sales tax break for buying locally manufactured cars. Could that have been rethought? I definitely think so. I mean, Malaysia, per capita ownership of cars in Malaysia is not only among the highest in Asia, it's among the highest in the world. There's a very good study from back in 2014 by the research firm Nielsen. Malaysia has the third highest vehicle ownership in the world. Okay, it's not evenly distributed. And there's tremendous aspirational demand in the population who have never owned a car. But did we need that? Could we instead have used the stimulus to nudge in a different direction? So I am cautiously optimistic, but I know many leaders will take the short option. And such is the state of the world right now. The political climate is very, very parochial, inward-looking, and the concept of we are all in this together is yet to sink in. Although we have now seen climate change as, you know, don't care about boundaries, and now COVID, don't care about boundaries. So collective action is a must. So withdrawal from collective action, withdrawal from multilateralism, withdrawal from acting like world leaders, is frankly, in my opinion, not the most prudent thinking at this point. I wouldn't be surprised if many governments act in a populist and take shortcuts, and we end up in a place that we don't want to be in. I mean, the climate crisis is, one news magazine called the COVID crisis as the climate crisis, but with your finger on the fast forward button. So you're sort of seeing exactly the same thing, but play out in a very short time.
That's a very good description.
it's brilliant. The climate crisis is getting more and more strident. And the 1.5 degree rise, if we don't rise to that challenge, very, very urgently, we are going to see some consequences of that for sure.
But I think, you know, just going back to what you said on the importance of collective action, you know, even if the leaders are failing us, at least maybe, hopefully, we can depend on collective action, you know, people responding by the power of their votes to vote in the right people, perhaps. I don't know. But I'm afraid we're running out of time, Niloy. Any last message that you'd like to leave us with?
Exactly what you picked up on during the interview, Juliet. Let's build forward better. Let's build for the future. And let's begin the conversation. No one is talking about dismantling what existed in a complete reboot. You know, when Airbnb comes in, it doesn't mean that the brick and mortar hotels just have to die or hotels go away. Let they coexist. And eventually, in the long run, there may be a shakeout. So nobody's saying one or the other. You know, moving away from fossil fuels is not the death of the petroleum industry. Let's all work this thing out together. Let's nudge towards a different future. So it's because we are building for the future now. This is the moment. This is the moment in time to take pause, reflect, and really move ahead to build for the future.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Niloy Banerjee. He is the UNDP resident representative for Malaysia, Singapore and Brunei Darussalam. And we were discussing, you know, the COVID-19 crisis, you know, assessing it as well as envisioning the recovery from it. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store and also on Spotify. And if you'd like to find out more about the work done by the UNDP and also, you know, more about this report that we were talking about, you can head to hdr.undp.org. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.